Hosting, email dgannon@kaxe.org. Weather tonight, thunderstorms during the evening with gusty winds and possible hail, clearing after midnight to partly cloudy skies, low 60 to 66.
Our forecast is for rates to stay close to this 6.6% range, at least through the end of the year.
Mortgage rates have edged down a bit in recent weeks. What's the outlook for the months to come?
For Thursday, August 21st, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Hurricane Erin is moving away from North Carolina as people there try to make sense of the impact.
In a normal hurricane, you would be inside because it would be raining and blowing sideways, and it's not. It's really strange.
And a new study of bird activity around the world finds that lots of birds are getting the day started earlier than ever.
Their day is almost an hour longer. They start vocalizing about 20 minutes earlier in the morning, and they stop vocalizing about, 30 minutes later in the evening.
And divorce rates are higher for people over 50 than for younger generations.
What's behind the trend of gray divorce?
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump visited the Park Police headquarters in Washington, D.C. tonight, giving a pep speech outside the building to National Guard troops and police. This after he deployed National Guard troops along with federal law enforcement officers to D.C., saying crime and homelessness were out of control, even as federal and local stats show violent crime has been going down. Trump says they're working on sprucing up the nation's capital.
We're going back to Congress for some money, and we're going to redo a lot of the pavement, a lot of the medians, a lot of the graffiti's all coming off real fast. It's going to come down real fast.
This as several Republican-led states say they are sending hundreds of their own Guard members to D.C. New details about the White House and the EU trade deal framework have come out. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben has more.
Under the deal, the U.S. will impose 15% tariffs on most EU imports, as previously announced. But the U.S. will also charge higher tariffs on European-made cars until the EU lowers tariffs on U.S. goods. The new information is not a formal agreement, but rather comes from a fact sheet released by the White House this morning. And there are still big questions. The fact sheet acknowledges that the two parties will still need to negotiate topics like cybersecurity and rules of origin. In addition, while Trump has touted an expected $600 billion EU investment in the U.S., it's not clear that investment will actually hit those levels. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
In Gaza, after Israel said it's moving forward with plans to take control of Gaza City, hundreds of Palestinians took to the streets, denouncing what they see as forced displacement. NPR's Anas Baba has more.
In the heart of Gaza City, hundreds of Palestinians chant in unison. The people want to end the war. Many carry signs. Some wave Palestinian flags and others simply raise their voices in protest. Among them, young girls hold up a large empty plate with the word Gaza written in the center, a quiet but powerful symbol of the hunger gripping the population. The demonstration was organized by the Palestinian Journalists Association to protest the Israeli military planned advance. And what many here fear is Israel's intention to push them out of their city for good. Gaza City officials say the city currently hosts around 1.2 million displaced residents. Israel says it plans to order them to move to the southern Gaza. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza City.
Sales of existing homes rose last month, thanks in part to a slight pullback in mortgage rates. The National Association of Realtors says home sales rose 2% in July from June. That's higher than economists were expecting. And home prices were up on an annual basis for the 25th consecutive month. You're listening to NPR News. A federal judge today ruled that President Trump's pick to be U.S. attorney for New Jersey has been unlawfully serving as the acting U.S. attorney for more than a month. Alina Hababa is Trump's former personal attorney, and she was appointed in March to an interim term. Last month, a panel of judges declined to extend her tenure. It's the latest legal battle over her and the Trump administration's attempts to install some top prosecutors. The Department of Justice says it will appeal. Hurricane Erin is lashing the coast of North Carolina, where flooding is threatening major highways that connects the barrier islands known as the Outer Banks. Cherise Piggott from member station WUNC has more.
The National Weather Service says the forecast still shows the potential for tropical storm force winds and dangerous surf with waves of 20 feet. Bob Woodard chairs a local board of commissioners. He says they're working with North Carolina's Department of Transportation.
We've got multiple places where the overwash came off over on NC-12. So we'll be able to get some pumps out there to pump NC-12, and NCDOT will be working very, very diligently to try to reestablish the dune line.
The dune line is what protects NC Highway 12. Woodard says he expects more ocean overwash later in the day after the area's last high tide. For NPR News, I'm Charisse Piggott.
Wall Street lower by the closing bell. The Dow down 152 points. The Nasdaq down 72. S&P 500 down 25. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. If you want to know about the economic mood in the U.S., take a look at housing, which can tell you a whole lot. It's been a few slow years in the housing market since mortgage rates shot up. But there are some signs and data that came out this week that things are shifting. NPR's Laurel Wamsley is here to talk about the latest. Hey there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Laurel, the latest home sales data came out today. It's from the National Association of Realtors. What's it have to say?
Well, the headline is that sales of existing homes were up a little bit in July compared to a month earlier. But it's been such a slow last 3 years, and there's really just a persistent sluggishness in the market. At the current pace, there will be about 4 million existing homes sold in the U.S. this year. That's far lower than during the pandemic, and significantly lower than before the pandemic, too.
Well, Laurel, tell us why it's so slow.
Basically, because it's so expensive to buy right now. Mortgage rates remain pretty high, averaging about 6.6% for a 30-year mortgage. And then home prices have risen a lot, nearly 50% in the last 5 years. That means that many people who want to buy a home simply can't afford to. The one thing we're seeing now is that prices are softening in some areas. Home values are increasing at their slowest pace in 2 years. That's largely because there's more inventory. Juana, maybe you and others have noticed more for sale signs this year. Mm-hmm. There are 16% more listings than there were a year ago. That's certainly good news for buyers. It gives them more options and more leverage to negotiate. For sellers, it's not so good. Homes are taking longer to sell now.
Now, Laurel, you mentioned mortgage rates. What's going on there?
Mortgage rates have inched down a bit in recent weeks to their lowest level since October 2024. That has spurred a jump in refinance activity, especially among those folks with mortgage rates above 7%. This has been a window to get a lower rate and shave potentially hundreds of dollars off the monthly payment. I asked Joel Kahn, Deputy Chief Economist at the Mortgage Bankers Association, about what might happen for mortgage rates in the months ahead. And he told me there are some opposing forces at play.
Our forecast is for rates to stay close to this 6.6% range, at least through the end of the year. You certainly have the expectation that if the Fed does start to cut rates, rates might come down. On the other side, you do have things like concerns around the debt and the deficit of the U.S. that is keeping rates higher.
And he also told me that anticipation of a possible Fed interest rate cut is already being factored into mortgage rates now, meaning they may not drop if and when that cut happens. He says next year they expect rates to get down to the 6.5% range, and there will likely be weeks when they dip below that. Of course, lots of people are hoping rates will come down further so they can make the math work on buying a home.
Right. So have rates come down enough to make moving attractive to homeowners who locked in those really low rates that we all saw during the pandemic?
Well, the fact that there's more inventory than there has been in years is a sign that some people are moving out and giving up those low rates. But lots of people aren't. We know that many are still stuck in homes that are too small or too big, but it just doesn't make sense to sell and give up those low rates and lower monthly payments. These small declines in mortgage rates, unfortunately, don't really change that.
Let's talk about inventory for a sec. We've been talking about a housing shortage and these sky-high prices. Any signs of that easing?
Well, data out this week from the Census Bureau shows that housing starts, that's the construction starting on homes, in July were up 5% over a month earlier. But at the same time, building permits were down compared to June. So there's a bit of a mixed picture there on where we're heading in terms of building. But there's definitely evidence that building more new homes helps bring prices down. In the South, where there are fewer restrictions on building new homes, a lot of new housing has been built in recent years. And now we see that prices are falling there compared to a year ago. That's even as a lot of people are still moving to the region. Meanwhile, in the Northeast and Midwest, where it's harder to build new homes, prices just keep rising.
NPR's Laura Walmsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
Allegedly, the early bird gets the worm. Well, now it looks like a lot of birds are starting their days earlier than ever. That is one of the findings of a sweeping new study of bird activity around the globe. NPR's Nell Greenfeld-Boyce reports on how scientists manage to track the daily doings of hundreds of species.
It used to be, if you wanted to know what birds were up to, you'd have to go out in the field with binoculars. Increasingly, though, bird lovers are relying on audio recordings like this one. That's a village weaver. And that's a northern flicker. These recordings were made by a project called Bird Weather. It sells little plastic devices that people can mount outside their homes. These devices have microphones to pick up bird calls and the computing power to identify the species in real time. Lots of people have installed these things.
They're like, hey, I like birds, kind of. I like to feed birds. What's in my backyard?
That's Brent Pease, a wildlife researcher with Southern Illinois University. What interested him was that BirdWeather has been collecting and storing all that audio from thousands of sites on multiple continents.
Really, I would say largely the wildlife science community doesn't even know this data set exists. And here we literally have over a billion bird vocalization detections on the BirdWeather platform since 2021 that tell us in real time how birds are behaving.
He says this really just blew his mind.
And I kept thinking about this data set, and I kept thinking about this data set.
He wanted to use it in some way. So he turned to a colleague, Neil Gilbert, at Oklahoma State University. Gilbert says he thought, well, what about light pollution? He knew of some research showing it affects certain birds, so he suggested,
you know, I think we can try to estimate light pollution effects for a whole bunch of species.
That's just what they did. They combined bird data with satellite data on light pollution, plus sunrise and sunset times. Gilbert says their analysis shows that unnaturally bright skies can really change the lives of birds.
These birds, effectively, their day is almost an hour longer. They start vocalizing about 20 minutes earlier in the morning, and they stop vocalizing about, you know, 30 minutes later in the evening.
That's an average effect over hundreds of species. Some birds show much bigger responses.
American robins will sometimes be singing, you know, 2 hours before sunrise in some of these light polluted areas.
And some species seem less influenced. For example, birds with small eyes, like the tufted titmouse, don't react much to artificial light. Neither do birds that roost in dark, enclosed nests or tree cavities. The findings appear in the journal Science. Jeff Bueller is with the University of Delaware. He's researched light pollution in birds and says the scope of this study is unprecedented.
Compared to what has been done in the past, in much smaller scale studies, only looking at a handful of species at a time.
What's not clear, though, is whether a longer day is good or bad for the birds. Maybe it means they get more time to forage for food, or maybe it interferes with their sleep. To understand all that, scientists would need to study individual species much more closely than just recording their calls. Nell Greenfeld-Boyce, NPR News.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. At 83 years old, Harrison Ford is still experiencing firsts, including his first ever Emmy nomination for his role in Shrinking on Apple TV+. He told wildcard host Rachel Martin about being pitched on the show by its co-creator, Brett Goldstein.
I read the pilot of Shrinking one time. I was doing an Indiana Jones movie, and Brett Goldstein sent me the script. And then he came to meet me to find out if I was interested or talk me into it or something like that. So. Yeah, I opened the door. I said, hi, you're Brett. Yeah, hi. Nice to see you. I'll do it.
Didn't even have a coffee.
No, but we did have a few scotches after that.
Ford reflected on his early career in his wildcard interview.
What's a piece of advice you were smart to ignore?
Every single piece of advice I ever got.
No one ever gave you good advice?
I don't know if I got a lot of advice.
Really?
No. Maybe because I didn't look like like I was interested. But I, when people ask me for advice, mm-hmm. and strangely, occasionally people do.
Yeah, I imagine.
The only thing I can say is whatever it is you want to do, don't imitate somebody else's way of getting there. Uh-huh. Don't try and imitate somebody else's success. You've got to find your own path.
How did you have that instinct so early, though?
I was belligerent.
Really?
Yeah, and ignorant at the same time.
That's a good combo.
Yeah.
So you didn't charm your way through the doors of Hollywood executives?
Decidedly not. The doors did not fly off the hinges when I appeared.
But something was working.
It was a very strange thing that happened. One, I really didn't go to movies very much. Two, I didn't know why I wanted to be an actor. But I discovered acting very late in my college career because I was looking for a class that I could take and get a good grade in, because I was a philosophy and English major, and I never went to class.
So you didn't have very good grades, I imagine.
I had terrible grades, and I was hanging out by the skin of my teeth. I got thrown out of school 4 days before graduation college. The first one in my family to ever have achieved the possibility of graduating
from
college.
And you blew it within 4 days?
4 days before graduation, I was asked to go away and not come back.
So the plan to get a good grade in the drama class didn't save you from getting kicked out of college?
You know, that's the first time I thought about that. It didn't. It didn't.
You can watch that full conversation with Harrison Ford by following Wildcard with Rachel Martin on YouTube. And the show Shrinking is available on Apple TV+.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is The Set List, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at shows Friday and Saturday, August 22nd and 23rd, near Itasca State Park, in Bemidji, Walker, and Grand Rapids. Starting things off with the Mississippi Headwaters Music Fest in Itasca Township this Friday and Saturday. Located not far from Itasca State Park, the festival's Friday lineup includes Forge North, The Bad Decisions, and more, with music beginning at 3 p.m. On Saturday, the Lydia Rose Band, Kitschy Boogie, and others are playing with music beginning at 12:30. The specific address can be found online. It's Mississippi Headwaters Music Fest this weekend. Also Friday night, Sam Miltich and the Clearwater Hot Club will be at Bridget's in Bemidji at 6 p.m., playing the Hot Club jazz of Django Reinhardt alongside straight-ahead tunes and Balkan folk music. The group feature original songs alongside jazz standards and folk traditionals. Sam Miltich and the Clearwater Hot Club Friday night at Bridget's in Bemidji. On Saturday, country and folk icon Steve Earle is coming to the Northern Lights Casino in Walker. Active since the mid-70s, Earl has 7 Grammy-nominated albums, winning 3 of them, and is best known for songs like Copperhead Road, Guitar Town, Galway Girl, and many more. Most recently, he continued a series of cover albums with a tribute to Jerry Jeff Walker in 2022. The opener is country singer Calder Allen. It's Steve Earle at Northern Lights Casino in Walker, this Saturday at 6. At the same time, folk rock quartet Morning Bird are playing Rapids Brewing in Grand Rapids. Led by multi-instrumentalist Jill Burks and Josh Palmy, the group is rounded out by the rhythm section of Shane Kingsland and Jim Pedala. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It is 5:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kivi, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. The 41st Annual Threshing and Antique Show is August 9th and 10th from 9 to 4 each day at the Blackberry Farm just east of Grand Rapids on Highway 2, with live music, demonstrations, a blacksmith shop, and much more. The Bemidji Senior Center is taking a trip to the Minnesota State Fair on Monday, August 25th. Stop by the Senior Center for more details and to register. Brainerd Community Action hosts a movie at the Lyman P. White Amphitheater Friday, August 8th at 9 p.m. See the original Jumanji starring Robin Williams. Bring your own chair or blanket. Concessions available. The City of Palisade hosts Riverfest Saturday, August 9th on Main Street. Events include pickleball, a duck race, a parade at noon, and live music from 4 to 8 p.m. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd offers guided hikes the third Thursday of each month at 9:30 a.m. Hikes are 1 hour long, and dogs are welcome on a leash. The 5th Annual Range Iron Pride Festival is Saturday, August 9th from 10 to 4 at the Iron Trail Motors Event Center in Virginia, with vendors, food trucks, and live entertainment. United Way of Bemidji Area is hosting Stuff the Bus, a school supply drive to benefit K-12 students at Bemidji Area Schools now through Tuesday, August 19th. Donations may be dropped at either Lukens Village Foods locations or the Tourist Information Center by Paul and Babe. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
Flooding from Hurricane Erin is expected to continue over the next few days, says North Carolina Emergency Management Director Will Ray.
This will be a longer duration event, with coastal flooding expected over several high tide cycles. We will see rain bands trailing Erin, which could lead to extended impacts.
Some houses could also be affected. In the village of Rodanthe, 11 homes have collapsed into the ocean since 2020. It looks like more houses could collapse, especially with Erin's strong waves. As meteorologist Jonathan Blaze with the National Weather Service points out, it's also part of the way the coastline naturally shifts over time.
Those outer banks, those are supposed to move. You know, nature has those there for a reason, and they're actually supposed to evolve and change.
Another high tide tonight is expected to bring more storm surge and flooding beyond the beachside. Dangerous rip currents are expected up and down the East Coast, and officials are urging people to stay out of the ocean as Hurricane Erin passes by. For NPR News, I'm Celeste Gracia.
Are you one of those people who has stayed in a relationship because you genuinely doubted that you could ever do better? Or maybe you thought, look, it's hard enough to make new friends later in life, let alone find love later in life. Well, hold that thought, because my next guest has some news for you. Brittany Luce is the host of NPR's It's Been a Minute, and once a month she joins us to unpack surprising trends in culture. Hi, Brittany.
Hi, Elsa. Here's my surprise.
Uh-huh.
Did you know that overall divorce rates are down except for one key demographic?
What key demographic?
People over 50.
Oh, I could have told you that, because that is exactly what it looks like on the dating apps I'm on. There are so many 50-something-year-olds.
Well, I'll say it's this trend that people are calling the gray divorce. And according to researchers I talked to, it's happening for a few reasons. First, we're living longer than past generations. Second, we are more culturally accepting of divorce than we have been in the past. And third, women in particular are more financially independent. And on top of all of that, Texas Tech University professor Dana Weiser, who studies human development and family sciences, she explained that across all generations, people just expect more from a marriage or partnership.
So that's one of the things that we can also see, is that we just have higher expectations. So if we go back, you know, why people got married was they would say, oh, they're a nice enough person. They come from a good family.
Mm-hmm. We have similar values. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now we're expecting our partners to be, you know, our best friend, someone we want to have sex with, someone who's hopefully going to share in with household labor, mm-hmm. be our main emotional support. So we just are having higher expectations for our relationships, which means then there's more opportunity to fall short of those expectations.
True.
Yeah. And Elsa, we're not only seeing a lower divorce rate for younger generations, but lower rates of marriage for younger people too.
Which is so interesting to me because I remember in my late 20s, a bunch of my friends got married, including myself. But I got divorced by the time I was 30. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that one of the factors that made that decision easier for me is that we didn't have kids. Life was still pretty simple financially. And now mm-hmm. I've been seeing friends going through divorces in like their 40s and 50s. And yeah, it can be so much more complicated, so much more acrimonious sometimes, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Professor Weiser and another professor of psychology I spoke with, Rosie Shrout from the University of British Columbia, they both emphasize the emotional difficulty of divorce as well as the difficulty of disentangling finances for older women. Mm-hmm. For example, Elsa, there was this 2021 study on gray divorce that found, based on income, women felt a 45% drop in standard of living after divorce
wow.
versus men's standard of living dropping 21%. But still, there's research that shows that the impact of a stressful marriage goes way beyond the financial.
If that relationship is not good, if it is negative, hostile, filled with poor communication, is abusive, neglectful, that has extremely harsh effects on our health and well-being. And so being in a relationship, being in a bad relationship, is much worse for our health than not being in a relationship.
Oh, that goes without saying. Mm. Yes. I mean, I would rather be on my own than be in a bad relationship because life is too short to waste your energy on bad choices, you know?
Listen, we are on the same page with that. But,
yeah.
you know, the way I think of this is that a bad relationship is a net negative. A good relationship is a net positive, and no relationship is a net neutral.
Okay, but tell us more about what dating looks like on the other side of this so-called gray divorce. I mean, speaking for myself, Brittany, as someone who does often date divorced men in their 40s and 50s, I have to say it is so attractive to meet someone who knows what they want in life, who has worked on themselves, who has learned from their mistakes and wants to do better. You know?
Yeah, and that was really interesting to me as well, because I think this is another way that generations are influencing one another. Professor Shrout explained to me that, especially for women over 50, mm-hmm. autonomy was very important. That for many women, they seek divorce because they're craving a sense of independence. And one way that these older generations are partnering is through something called living apart together.
Oh my God. That is my dream. I want to be in a relationship with someone, but we each have our own house. I love having my own sanctuary, my own space. I never want to give up my space.
Exactly.
Do you think I'm relationship ready?
Listen, for those who have gray divorce and are looking for love, you are right in the pocket. I mean, Professor Shrout talked about how this kind of partnership provided these women a sense of autonomy, a value that appeals to younger women too. So younger generations are modeling this higher expectation for relationships, and older generations are offering new ideas of how to structure relationships. It's pretty cool.
I love that. Brittany, thank you so much for sharing all of this with us.
Oh my gosh, you're so welcome, Elsa. Thank you for having me.
That was Brittany Luce. She's the host of NPR's It's Been a Minute, a show about what is going on in culture.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Support for KAXE comes from Timberlake Restaurant, offering fresh baked popovers, crafted cocktails, and menu items such as walleye a la Ritz or chicken Kiev. Information about the dinner menu is available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Now it's time for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources has confirmed the invasive algae starry stonewort in four more lakes. This includes three in northern Minnesota: Garfield Lake near LaPorte in Hubbard County, Gull Lake 1 mile west of Ten Strike in Beltrami County, and Three Island Lake near Turtle River, also in Beltrami. Starry stonewort was found in these lakes during the recent Starry Trek event in early August. The annual event sees county and state staff and volunteers searching lakes for starry stonewort and other aquatic invasive species. Starry stonewort is usually identified by the star-shaped, white, bulb-like structures on the plant. These typically become visible in late summer. It can form dense mats, which can interfere with recreational uses of a lake and compete with native plants. Wild rice season technically opened over a week ago, but harvesting is still a ways out. Wet weather has created unique conditions this year. Megan Buffington has more.
Jordan Williams wouldn't go so far as to call this year a bumper crop, but he will say the rice is looking really, really nice.
Really thick, tall rice. If you know of any other place that, you know, typically has wild rice, it's probably going to have just a little bit more this year.
Williams is a wildlife biologist for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Department of Natural Resources. The rice is looking much better than it has in recent years, when drought has limited harvests, and low water meant you couldn't reach the stands that did do well. That's one advantage of all the rain this summer.
This year is something that I haven't really noticed before, ever, my experience, where we've had enough water to get just about anywhere you need to, and then you still have just a really, really thick rice bed.
The Minnesota DNR's Wild Rice Outlook promises similar success for many ricers, though high water and summer storms did impact some stands. The DNR reminds ricers that it's illegal to harvest green rice. He has a couple more reminders.
Make sure, you come with prepared with all your safety equipment, life jackets, and cell phone. Make sure people know where you're at. Making sure that, you're going out there and harvesting in a respectful way.
Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
Nearly 120 acres of land will become part of the Namaji State Forest south of Cloquet, thanks to a donation from the Trust for Public Land. The DNR received the land donation from the nonprofit after it acquired parcels bordering the forest from private property owners using grants from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. The parcel added to the forest features mixed hardwood and protects wildlife habitat in an area valued for outdoor recreation. A news release says the acquisition also supports watershed protection, provides the opportunity for better forest management, and safeguards land from fragmentation due to development. Four projects in northern Minnesota gained support from the Urban Agriculture Grants from the Minnesota Department of Ag. These competitive grants aim to promote youth agricultural education and agriculture-connected community development. The Boys and Girls Club of the Bemidji area will revitalize the club's garden space. They will begin a new curriculum, capture rainwater to eliminate flooding, add a pollinator garden, and develop a plan to build sustainability into the program. The Headwaters Regional Development Commission in Bemidji will revitalize the Conifer Estates Community Garden. The Northwestern Minnesota Juvenile Center in Bemidji will provide hands-on agricultural opportunities to the youths housed there. They will restore a greenhouse with utilities, create a fenced-in space to add more garden beds, and purchase equipment. Hermantown Community Schools will develop a learning garden. The garden is intended to expose kids from pre-kindergarten through 5 years old to the growth cycle and the process of growing food. Nashwaukewatin is gathering input on the future of a historic school mural. The mosaic in the old high school library was built in the 60s, according to the 2003 Nashwauk Centennial Book. The 105-square-foot mosaic is made of some 15,000 Venetian glass tiles from Italy. It depicts the history of the area, including mining and railroad imagery, and a church, schools, and other historic structures. Nashwaukewatin is moving into its new school this fall. That's where the listening session about the mural will be at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. One of the most prominent conservative evangelical leaders in the U.S. has died. James Dobson was 89 years old. He founded the media organization Focus on the Family, the Family Research Council think tank, and a lobbying group called the Family Policy Alliance. Joining me to talk about Dobson is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Hey, Jason.
Hello.
How influential was Dobson for the conservative Christians?
Well, Mary Louise, he was enormously important, and not just for conservatives. He shaped the culture wars and had real political impact. He's right up there with Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority and the Christian Broadcasting Network creator Pat Robertson. Dobson founded Focus on the Family back in 1977 and really solidified the conservative idea of family values. His radio program was heard on hundreds of stations in the U.S. and even internationally, and it shaped the conservative religious agenda. He wanted the Bible taught in schools. He was in favor of school prayer. He favored corporal punishment. And he opposed abortion rights. He opposed the teaching of evolution. And he had a particular focus on opposition to LGBTQ rights.
And I want to ask about that last one, LGBTQ rights, which he opposed. Why was that important to him?
Well, he believed the Bible should shape public policy, and Dobson really saw the broader societal acceptance of LGBTQ people as a direct opposition to his understanding of the Bible and the family. And he was extremely upset about the legalization of same-sex marriage. Here's Dobson speaking on the Christian TV program Andrew Womack Ministries about the Supreme Court's decision.
That decision is not really about gay marriage. It's not. It's about everything else. It's about the entire culture war. We lost the entire culture war with that one decision.
However, Mary Louise, a few years later, he felt that perhaps his side was gaining ground again in the culture wars when the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade and ended the national right to abortion.
Jason, you said that Dobson founded Focus on the Family back in the 1970s. He did eventually step down from the leadership role at the helm, but he remained influential. More recently, what has been his impact?
Well, you might remember that early on in Donald Trump's political career, there was concern from evangelical Christians that Trump wasn't a good standard bearer. He'd been married multiple times, lots of scandals regarding his personal life. But Dobson came to champion him, and Dobson's blessing of Trump helped galvanize other evangelical Christians behind him. Here's Dobson speaking on CBN, the Christian Broadcasting Network, about Trump.
He's much more of a gentleman than anybody knows he is, and he has kept every promise he made to the faith community. I really do love and appreciate that man.
Promises like appointing Supreme Court justices who eventually overturned abortion rights.
Indeed. Well, that leads me to the last thing I wanted to ask you, which is you cover religion. What do you think his legacy will be?
Well, Mary Louise, that depends on which side of the culture wars people are on. For conservative evangelical Christians, Dobson was a hero who used his influence to get voters to the polls and shape national policy. The current head of the Family Research Council put out a statement today saying, quote, "Few people have had the positive, Christ-honoring impact on the family as James Dobson." But for progressives, both secular and religious progressives, Dobson was a villain who demonized the people he opposed religiously and politically and worked to curtail their rights.
NPR's Jason DeRose, thank you.
You're welcome.
This week, Hamas accepted a proposal from Egypt and Qatar for a ceasefire in Gaza. Now Israel is considering its response. What motivated Hamas to make that decision now, and what is its strategy for the future? NPR's Daniel Estrin reports.
Nearly 2 years after it launched the surprise attack that sparked the war with Israel, Hamas is facing its worst crisis yet, says Palestinian political analyst and former militant Esmat Mansour. He's in touch with figures close to Hamas. Hamas faces pressures from all directions, he says, from Israel, from the street, from the West, and from Arab countries. Last month, for the first time, the 22 countries of the Arab League called in a statement for Hamas to give up control of Gaza and hand over its weapons. Hamas's main goal is to exist and only to exist, Mansour says. Israel is trying to end Hamas's existence as a military and governing force in Gaza. Hamas knows militarily Israel is stronger. Mansour says one thing that plays to Hamas's advantage is Israelis' impatience as the war drags on. He says Israeli soldiers will get tired, Israelis will increasingly protest to end the war, international pressure will increase on Israel, and all Hamas must do is preserve its one bargaining chip, the hostages. Ibrahim El-Madhoun, a Palestinian analyst in Turkey who's close to Hamas, says Hamas is trying to improve its relations with Arab governments. He says the main disagreement between Hamas and the Arab countries is using weapons against Israel. But he says their governments realize the Palestinian cause is important to their people and Hamas is the primary player. Samir Ghattas is an Egyptian security analyst who studies Hamas and Gaza. He says Hamas is wrong. Arabs support Gazans, not Hamas. Hamas has no real military capabilities left, he says, just localized guerrilla warfare. But Hamas also refuses to give up its weapons and join the internationally recognized Palestinian leadership committed to diplomacy. So Hamas is stepping up its fighting. On Wednesday, a group of Hamas militants stormed an Israeli military position in southern Gaza, leading to close-range fighting. Most of the Hamas militants were killed, according to the Israeli military. Israel thinks Hamas may have tried to abduct a soldier. The ambush demonstrates how Hamas is still willing to fight at all costs. In Gaza, 35-year-old Mohammed Ahmad tells NPR producer Anas Baba that Hamas cannot afford to give up its weapons now. No one will accept during a battle and a continuous fight with the occupation to surrender their weapons, he says. The Israelis will not leave Gaza if Hamas surrenders its weapons. 22-year-old Amjad Saleh says civilians, not Hamas, are paying the price of the war. Hamas is not here at all. Their leaders are either abroad or in the tunnels underground in Gaza. They conduct their operations and we get punished for it, he says. The plan for displacement is coming. That displacement is Palestinians' biggest concern now. Israel's military is calling up tens of thousands more soldiers and vowing in the coming weeks to take control of Gaza City and drive out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to southern Gaza near the Egyptian border. Israel eventually seeks to send as many Palestinians as possible to other countries. That could be one major driving factor for Egypt to help propose a new ceasefire and for Hamas to support it, to hold off the bigger concern of a mass displacement of Palestinians from Gaza into Egypt or beyond. Daniel Estrin, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Louis Sacker is famous for his books for kids. You might recognize his name from the award-winning novel Holes or the goofy Wayside School series. With his latest book, Sacker is taking on a new challenge, writing for adults. Here's Andrew Limbong, host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast.
Louis Sacker's new book, The Magician of Tiger Castle, centers around Anatole, in the 16th century kingdom of Escovita. He's a potions guy. He experiments with brews and tinctures. He's decent at it, but not always successful. One project gone awry left him with no hair.
So that throughout the book, you never know if something's going to go really horribly wrong in any of his experiments.
Lewis Sacker.
I also, you know, now that I'm 70, I have hair growing out of my ears and my nose, and I hate having all this hair, so, you know, I think part of it is just, boy, it'd be nice not to have any hair.
Anatole, the middle-aged hairless magician, is close friends with Princess Tulia, who is set to marry the awful prince of our rival kingdom, even though she is in love with a man named Pedo, who happens to be locked up in the dungeon of the castle. Sacker said the original drafts of the story was supposed to be a kid's story focusing on the romance between the princess and Pedo. Anatole was just a quirky narrator.
After a while, he took over the story, and you can't really have a children's book with a 40-year-old main character.
Dungeons and princesses and potions. I asked Sacker if there was an intentional irony for his first adult novel to be so once upon a time.
I think I was inspired by one of my favorite books when I was first really getting into reading and writing, and that was The Princess Bride.
And Sacker knows a thing or two about inspiring kids who are first getting into reading. When we spoke, Sacker was on book tour, and he said he was hearing from tons of people around my age, adults, who had Sacker's words imprinted on them when they were younger.
You know, when I first started writing children's books, I was in my early 20s. I'm now in my early 70s. And I feel less connected to kids now, but I feel still I'm connected to the people like you who grew up reading my books. And I'm hoping that you'll feel the same kind of fun and joy and excitement reading this book as you remember from Holes or Wayside School.
Writing for adults was always the goal for Sacker.
I remember when I first started out, you know, thinking I'm just going to write one children's book and then become a serious writer. And I remember thinking I wanted to just write fun stories to get kids to realize how enjoyable reading can be.
It's interesting how you phrase that. You said you were just going to write one children's book and then become a, quote, serious writer, which I believe was the word that you used.
Yeah, I mean, that was then. I don't discount the seriousness of writing children's books.
Yeah.
But at the time, I did.
Was that a process? When did you get over that?
I think when my first book was published, and I thought, well, I'll do another one.
Sacker dedicated The Magician of Tiger Castle to the Cool Breezers, which are a crew of friends Sacker had in high school. They lost touch over time, but in the last 20 years or so, started reconnecting. And now the Cool Breezers are closer than ever. For a certain generation, this book is like checking back in with an old friend. A touch wiser, maybe a bit more concerned with ear and nose hair than before, but just as good of a hang as ever. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Grand Rapids Riverfest is Saturday, September 6th. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at GrandRapidsRiverfest.com. Want to volunteer at the event? Head to GrandRapidsRiverfest.com under Get Involved. And now a message paid for by the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there is 988, with support that meets you where you are, confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help when you need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org. The Meiji Pride Festival is going on now through Saturday, August 23rd at Rail River Folk School. Find a full schedule of events at BemidjiPride.com. And you can visit the KAXE KBXE booth on Saturday during the family-friendly festival from noon to 5 p.m. We receive support from the Grand Rapids Farmers Market, open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Golf Course Road and Pokegama Avenue, offering an EBT double match and many more programs bringing produce to members of our community. More at grfarmersmarket.com. MorrowDonor.org. There's a local drive for the National Morrow Donor Program tomorrow from 11 to 2 and again from 5 to 7 at the Grand Rapids Dairy Queen. Healthy individuals ages 18 to 35 can get their cheeks swabbed at the event and register to possibly save a life. Sometimes the only hope for a cure comes from an unrelated donor. You can also join the registry by texting Cure Cancer Today without spaces to 61474. United Way of 1000 Lakes has many volunteer opportunities in Itasca County. Find a list and sign up at volunteer.uwlakes.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump visited with patrolling National Guard and federal law enforcement officials today in Washington, D.C. He thanked them for their work and gave them hamburgers from the White House. The new patrols around D.C. have led to protests and questions about how long the federal takeover of the city can last. As NPR's Rachel Treisman reports, that depends on which forces you're talking about.
It's been over a week since President Trump activated D.C.'s National Guard and asserted control of its Metropolitan Police Department. He says he did so to make D.C. safer, but police data shows crime has been on the decline since 2023, well before he declared an emergency.
If crime is already down, then at what point do they say mission accomplished?
That's Meryl Chertoff, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center.
Or is the mission going to last endlessly? Because you're never going to drive crime down to zero.
The president has some limits under the Home Rule Act. He can only control D.C.'s police for 30 days, unless Congress authorizes an extension. And that's what Trump is hoping for already.
We're going to do this very quickly, but we're going to want extensions. I don't want to call national emergency. If I have to, I will. But I think the Republicans in Congress will approve this pretty much unanimously.
D.C.'s National Guard is different. It's under Trump's command, so he can use it as long as he wants. The limits of that control haven't really been tested in court, says Elizabeth Goitein of the Brennan Center for Justice.
Part of that is because what the president is doing right now is really unprecedented.
Presidents have deployed D.C.'s National Guard before, including for civil rights protests in 1968 and 2020. But those were specific events, not a broad issue like crime.
It's not clear what could bring this to an end other than intervention by the courts, by Congress, or overwhelming public disapproval.
The White House declined to comment on a timeline for the Guard's potential withdrawal. And the number of troops is still growing as Republican governors deploy their state guards to D.C. It's not clear how long they'll stay either.
The governor of South Carolina was very forthright about the fact that the forces will be recalled if there is a hurricane or another natural disaster that requires the use of the Guard.
Goitein says the National Guard is meant to be on the front lines of events like disaster relief, not local crime. That, she says, is a matter for local law enforcement, even in the nation's capital. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
It's time now for the Healthcare Helpline. It's a new series we're launching today in partnership with the Kaiser Family Foundation and KFF Health News. Here's how it works. You send us your questions about navigating the healthcare system, and we send out our policy sleuths to investigate and report back. Today, we're hearing from Anna Deutscher. She's 29 years old and lives in Minnesota.
I reached out to you because I wanted to know why my son's hearing tests weren't covered by our insurance and why we needed to pay for it.
Jackie Fortier is on the case. She's with our partner KFF Health News. Jackie, you spoke to Anna. What's going on with her son's hearing?
Hey, Ari. So Anna's baby son, Beckham, was born with CMV.
I haven't heard of that before. What is it?
I hadn't heard of it either. It's a super common virus. Most of the time, it's no big deal. Lots of kids get it as a toddler. But it is concerning if it happens in utero while the brain is forming. That's what happened to Beckham. The doctor told Anna not to Google it.
I absolutely Googled it right away because that's just the kind of person I am. I'm not about to not Google it.
She found out baby Beckham has a 1 in 5 chance of long-term health problems, especially hearing loss. Hmm. And if babies can't hear, it can make it difficult to learn to talk. So doctors say his hearing really needs to be tested every few months.
But she said her insurance isn't going to pay for those tests, even if they're essential. What kind of cost are we talking about here?
Yeah, he's had 2 tests. They were about $340 a pop. He needs 19 more in the next few years. I asked her if she's done the math.
I have done the math.
Anna's fighting this because she knows as Beckham gets older, the family will be on the hook for $6,500 just for his hearing tests. And that's if nothing goes wrong. Beckham's other healthcare bills are already hard to keep up with. The family's maxed out 2 credit cards.
Every cent of a bonus or Christmas money or tax returns, everything just immediately goes right to trying to pay that debt off.
Spending Christmas money on hearing tests sounds awful. Why isn't the insurance covering this?
Well, the plan says in black and white that it does not cover hearing tests, but that seemed kind of weird to me. So I called an insurance expert, Joanne Volk. She's a professor at Georgetown University, and she actually showed me a list of preventative services for kids that are supposed to be covered by law. Hearing tests are on that list.
But it really does come down to everyone sort of being on their best behavior on the provider and plan side to truly interpret and follow, you know, what should be covered.
So the law says hearing tests must be covered. The insurance plan says hearing tests won't be covered. What has to happen to get everybody on the same page?
Well, that all comes down to something called medical coding. It's the shorthand that hospitals use to tell an insurance company exactly what the doctor is billing for. 3 digits can be the difference between getting care covered or owing thousands of dollars.
What did you see when you looked at those bills with the medical coding?
Well, I had no idea, so I sent the paperwork to someone who did. Rhonda Buchholz is a billing expert. She took a look and said one code was missing on some of the bills.
They've got to make sure they use one for the baby's condition so that they understand that it was medically necessary.
Rhonda thinks the bill is getting flagged for a denial because it didn't say anything about the reason for the hearing tests. The CMV code is missing.
So if the doctor puts in the CMV code, is the family no longer going to have to pay out of pocket?
Well, not according to the doctor's office. They said that they didn't mess up anything in the coding. So instead, Anna explored other ways to get her money back. She went through every appeal the insurance company allowed and was denied every time.
I was expecting it, but I was still very frustrated with it.
Is that just another dead end? Is Anna out of options now?
Not quite. Our billing expert, Rhonda, had one more idea.
They could go and talk to their employer, and the employer could advocate to get those services covered.
She recommends asking your company's human resources department for help. HR has contacts that you don't. And in Anna's case, it worked. Her employer covered the cost of the hearing tests for this year.
For this year? Well, what did Anna say about that?
It's just been like this constant kind of cloud hanging over my head. So for that to suddenly just like be lifted, it didn't feel real. It didn't feel real at the time.
Anna's employer also added hearing tests to the 2026 policy. So now all of Beckham's future hearing tests will be paid for by insurance. So the takeaway is, if you think something is preventive and should be paid for, keep pushing and, you know, maybe call HR.
Thanks for the detective work. That is Jackie Fortier of KFF Health News.
Thank you, Ari.
And Healthcare Helpline wants to hear from you. Go to npr.org and send us your questions or frustrations about navigating the healthcare system.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic, with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. Looking at weather tonight, thunderstorms during the evening with gusty winds.